What does it mean to be religious? Few topics are as touchy as talking about one's religion or lack of belief. I'm Susan Sharon, in today for Keith Shortall, and today we continue our What Does It Mean series with a discussion about what it means to be religious. Joining me to talk about how they define religion and what their beliefs mean in their everyday lives are guests who represent a few of the different faiths practiced here in Maine. Akiva Hertzfeld is the rabbi at the Congregation Sherry Tefillah in Portland. Pamela Shellberg is assistant professor in New Testament at the Bangor Theological Seminary. And Omar Conte joins us from our Bangor studio. He's the outreach coordinator at the Islamic Center of Maine in Orono. And joining us a little later in the show will be Ryan D'Alessandro, founder and co-organizer of the Atheists of Maine Facebook page. We'd like you to share what religion means to you. Email talk at mpbn.net, post a comment on our Facebook page, send us a tweet at Maine Calling, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. What does religion mean to you? This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN radio listener contributions and by Portland Stage, where A Christmas Carol returns this season complete with ghostly apparitions, music, and traditional caroling. PortlandStage.com.
Rabbi Akiva Hertzfeld, Pamela Shellberg, and Omar Conte, thank you so much for joining us on Maine Calling. I'm Susan Sharon, in today for Keith Shortall. It's been a very difficult week in America, as we all struggle to make sense of the shocking act of violence against innocent children and teachers in a quiet Connecticut suburb on Friday. When we first scheduled this program, the events in Newtown had not yet happened. But as we begin this discussion about religion, let me ask you, how can any of us, whether we are religious or not, make sense of this tragedy? And how does your faith get you through it? I'll begin with you, Pamela.
Well, I'm not sure I can say that my faith will get me through it, although my faith does accompany me as it accompanies all of us as we try to process it. The Christian tradition will offer much language and a variety of images about the life hereafter and a hope for that life and a promise for a life beyond what we know here. But the Christian tradition also offers practices and a commitment, a conviction about a communal life. This is what gets us through it, is the participation with each other in the tragedy, the kneeling beside the crumbled bodies of grieving mothers, the will to grieve openly, to stand with people who are grieving, and to just try to have a sort of a ministry of presence, of bodily incarnational presence of love to people who desperately need it now.
And Rabbi, what would you say?
Well, sitting here in Maine, I can't even imagine the pain that's being experienced in Connecticut. So it's hard for me to offer any words of wisdom to them experiencing such pain down there. What we have to wonder at this point, in addition to extending our condolences and our grief with the families who are suffering there and the whole community that's suffering, when the time is appropriate, we ask as a society how we can prevent evil acts like happened from happening again in our country. We have to deal with what our society can do to prevent evil things like this from happening all the time, as seem to be taking place repeatedly in the country. We continue to have attacks in schools and college campuses with guns and great violence. So what is the religion going to answer to that? Because when things like this happen, it's not God that's causing the evil to happen. It's human beings who are killing other human beings. So what does religion teach us when we have people doing great harm to other people? And we have to look at issues relating to gun control, issues in dealing with the mentally ill, issues in dealing with the way we imprison people who are committing drug crimes in our country. All these issues are things that our religions and Judaism, as a rabbi in Orthodox Judaism, we have the answers of our religion, and hopefully that can provide a positive knowledge for the for the way our country progresses going forward.
Thank you. Omar Kante, I would turn to you as the outreach coordinator of the Islamic Center of Maine and Orono. What are your thoughts about Friday and about how the role of your religion or others play in helping get people through a tragedy like this?
I mean, indeed, it was a tragic event that happened in Connecticut on Friday. And our hearts and prayers go to the families and the community in Connecticut, in Newtown, Connecticut. The Islamic religion teaches the Muslims that when they hear tragedy, when they hear evil that happens, somebody lose a life, we are taught to immediately say that what we say in Arabic, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un," which means to God we belong and to Him we will all return eventually. You make a prayer for the ones, the deceased one, the people who are lost. And Islam also teaches us to be patient in times of tragedy, in times of pain and suffering. And it teaches that, you know, taking the life of such innocent human beings. Islam teaches in the Quran that if you take one innocent life, it is as if you have taken the entire humanity. So on Friday, the 26, 27 innocent people who have passed away, it is as if this young man has taken, I've murdered the entire humanity 27 times over. Every one of them, every single one of them represents the entire humanity. So Islam teaches patience, prayer, and support for your fellow human beings and individuals who are suffering. And do whatever you can to lend them a helping hand to, you know, ease the pain as much as possible. And also, Islam teaches that for every difficulty, there is ease. For every difficulty, there is ease in the end.
The number to call to join this conversation is 1-800-399-3566. What does religion mean to you? You often hear people after something like this say, how would a God allow something like this to happen? A couple of you touched on this, but what do you say to that? And have any of you had your faith tested in such a deep way? Rabbi, can you answer that?
Well, again, I touched on it, like that this was a human being who killed other human beings, and a lot of the media is speculating about what type of human being he was. I have no idea. In truth, I found this news story to be too difficult to even look at very closely. I didn't want to see the pictures or learn too much about it. But right here in Maine, we have a problem with imprisonment and dealing with the mentally ill in our society. And it's appropriate for us to ask, what do we do in Maine for people who are mentally ill? What do we do in Maine with the way we imprison people? How do people end up in prison? Are they committing drug crimes and going into prison? And is prison helping things? Is prison making people more mentally ill? And how are the drug the gun control laws in place in Maine? Are we allowing people to buy automatic weapons that can be used to kill people? And is that the proper approach? So I really, you know, the question of how our society should run and how we can stop tragedies from this from occurring by the hands of other human beings is a question to ask. Why God could allow something like this to happen? The Book of Job says, the ways of God are beyond us. We can't understand why God would allow little children to be killed and those lives taken. We can offer comfort to the families and the knowledge that our lives in this world are temporary, that our soul is eternal, our soul continues to the afterlife. That's what Judaism and many of the world religions teach us. So this is the knowledge for the people who have suffered a great loss. They can take that knowledge that the soul will continue, that their children's lives will continue, their souls will continue, and they'll be able to encounter the soul again in the afterlife. That's what our religion teaches about that.
Pamela Shelberg, have you ever had your faith tested?
Of course, I think that most people of faith would say that they have. And I imagine, without going into personal details, I've had my faith tested along the line of the question, how does God allow, how does God allow certain things to happen, the things that we might call evil in the world? And I would say that I think the question is a human question. It's the human question to say, how does God allow? Because in our times of brokenness and our most desperate need, perhaps our sense of abandonment or loss or a profound grief, we look for reasons and we look for explanations and we look for agents and causes. And so when things are too big for us to hold, we look to the thing that is bigger than we are, which some of us name God, and then we want to ask, how does God allow that? When people ask me that question now, I just try to hold space for the question, because it is part of, as the rabbi alluded to, it's part of the archetypal story of Job that we have this wondering. And it is only with some patience and with the allowance of a grief to work through and to be open, to find ourselves open to something else, which is often the love of humanity that comes into the broken spaces to work its healing and to present to us bodily a different perspective or a different image of God, actually. When, if people were to say, ask me how did God allow the events in Connecticut, I would probably just try to hold the question and not answer the question, but I would try to speak to people's imagination and hope and to focus attention on the response of religious and non-religious people to that tragedy in love. You know, love is not for the faint-hearted. Love requires a great deal of strength and will and a willingness to take one's pain, another person's pain into one's own heart and do that with some patience and persistence and will.
Love would seem to be a unifying theme
indeed
through all of your religions. And I should back up a bit and ask you, and I'll ask you, Omar Kante, you know, to ask about how you would define your faith and what does it mean to you?
I would define my faith as something that is a compass, a guide for me in my daily life, a guide that I believe will lead me to a better place in the end, no matter how rough or how hard the road might be. My faith gets me through the good times, and it gets me through the hard times, and it gives me, you know, the steady belief and strength to push through and to celebrate the good times and to grieve the bad times and be patient along the way. And my faith, it's everything. It relates to everything in my life, in the way personally, the way I relate to people, the way I relate to my environment, the way I relate to my family, and in every aspect of life, that it is a guiding point. It is something that you fall back on. It's something that you run to when you need answers for something. So it's been a very stabilizing factor of my life.
And has it been tested, as I asked Pamela, has yours been tested along your way?
Everybody's faith at one point or another is tested, but my faith has never been tested in the way that the families and the community in Connecticut has been tested on Friday. As human beings, we believe that God has given us the free will to love, the free will to live life the way we see fit. But he also showed us, we believe, the right way and the wrong way. And if we take that free will and we choose to do what we want with it, when somebody like Mr. Lanza commits such a horrible act, and we are left baffled without any answers, we run to God, who we see as the most powerful, the one who's with all knowledge, try to find answers from God. But at the same time, we don't believe that we could put it on God, that how can God allow this to happen? Because if we choose to believe that God interferes in every aspect of our lives, then that free will that we have will not be there anymore.
All right.
So,
all right. Thank you very much. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, please stay with us. This is Maine Calling. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Chase, creator of The Sopranos, about his first film, Not Fade Away. Set in New Jersey in the 60s, it's about the lead singer and a high school garage band emulating the Rolling Stones and Dylan. We'll also talk with Steven Van Zandt of Springsteen's band, the movie's music supervisor. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
For many of us, the best part of the holidays is the chance to see old friends or to hear them. For several decades now, Paul Winter has made our holidays brighter with his winter consort and musical guests at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I'm John Schaefer. Join us for the performance, Paul Winter's 32nd Winter Solstice Celebration from NPR Music.
Join us for that Friday at 9. For a complete list of holiday specials on MPBN Radio and Television, visit mpbn.net. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by the Green Store in Belfast, providers of fair trade gifts, games, and gadgets, greenstore.com, old-fashioned necessities for the new millennium, and by Portland's Downtown District, offering holiday shoppers a directory of stores, restaurants, and seasonal events online at portlandmaine.com.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Susan Sharon, in today for Keith Shortall. Today on the program, what does it mean to be religious? With me in the studio, Akiva Hertzfeld. He's a rabbi at Congregation Sherry Tefillah in Portland. Pamela Shellberg is an assistant professor in New Testament at the Bangor Theological Seminary. And with us from our Bangor studios is Omar Conte, outreach coordinator at the Islamic Center of Maine in Orono. And now joining us on the line is Ryan D'Alessandro. He's the founder and co-organizer of the Atheists of Maine Facebook page. Ryan, thank you for coming.
Very much for having me.
Let me begin with a question. What does being religious mean to you as an atheist?
Well, I mean, everyone has their go-to when they have, like you were talking about earlier, to see how you cope with tragedies that happened in Newtown, Connecticut. Well, I can't speak for every single atheist because we don't have a certain book that we refer to for guidelines on how to live and everything like that. But what I did personally, I went and picked up my son from school early because my son is in kindergarten. So that really hit home close to me. So I went up, I picked my son up from school early and I hugged that little guy extra tight, and, you know, it really made me appreciate something that could be taken away from me so easily, apparently. And all what I did to cope with it was I just sat down and wrote down several different ways to maybe try and prevent these types of things in the future. What I didn't do was point fingers. I didn't blame this person or blame that person, or because that, I feel, gets us nowhere, and we get caught up in the blame game, if you will.
Do you think that that the lack of participation in organized religion helps you or hinders you in getting through something like this?
Really, I haven't noticed a hindrance, because I used to believe in God up to about, I guess, 13 or 14, and I really don't foresee it as a hindrance at all. I realize that life is all we have on this planet, and I believe that it makes life more important in that sense, and so I'm more apt to appreciate what I have now instead of, you know, just trying to get through life just to get to the afterlife, if you will.
Does being an atheist, do you think, does that mean that you consider yourself, or do other atheists consider themselves, anti-religious?
No. Again, I can't speak for every atheist, but I think the general consensus is we're not here to take away anybody's religion. We just want to coexist peacefully. We're not, you know, some states we're legally discriminated against. Like, we can't take office just because we don't believe in, you know, a higher power, which obviously isn't fair and doesn't coincide with the First Amendment. But, I mean, I'm trying to gain my train of thought here.
Let me ask you a different question just before we lose you, and that is just if there were any misconceptions about atheists, what would you want people to understand?
That we're good people. You know, like I said earlier, I have my son. I love my family. We all have people that we love, and we just want to coexist peacefully. And, you know, we all hold doors open for LGBT women. We all stop for crosswalk pedestrians. We're good people that just find that there's not enough or not any evidence necessary for us to believe in a higher power.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
The number to call if you would like to join this conversation is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We did get a couple of questions on our Facebook page, and I want to repeat one of them from Kyle, who says, and I will ask the guests in the studio, for me, what being religious means, it is in part the understanding of something that is undefinable, that flows through us, around us, connects us, feeds us, leads us, follows, and dwells within us. And he says, I realize that this sounds so much like Yoda from Star Wars, but this for me is the epitome of what religion is. It's praying when you can't pray or when you don't, praying without saying or thinking a thing, just being is the prayer at times. Does anybody want to weigh in on that, Pamela?
I think Kyle's language for that is quite lovely, and I think speaks to what I believe is a truth about all human beings, that we are wired to be spiritual beings, and by that I mean that we are wired to apprehend beauty, mystery, that we are wired for a sense of wonder and awe, that we are actually wired to love and to have some apprehension. I guess this is more my faith conviction, that it's an apprehension, that mystery, wonder, and awe of something that is greater than us, sort of beyond and outside us. And then for me, to step off of what Kyle says, the religious part is actually the decision to be a part of a community or a group of people that historically, presently and historically, have given the language, the vocabulary that shapes an imagination for what we wonder about, that shapes our imagination for that mystery, but also provides some discipline and the help of a community to live into what that imagination calls forth, because it's hard to do it. To live according to what we imagine is really quite challenging. When Kyle talks about praying when it's hard to pray, it is often the religious community that helps us to do that, and often when we're unable to pray ourselves.
All right, we are going to take a call from Claire in South Portland. Claire, are you there?
Yes, hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about the earlier question on when there's a tragedy and how religion might help. And then just to relate the personal anecdote, in my own case, when one of my sisters died in an accident, our mother, who's very religious, instead of getting comfort, she was terrified because my sister had not been practicing the religion at the time and did not receive last rites and therefore might have gone to hell. And therefore, it called into question my mother's parenting and her failure to assure the eternal salvation of the soul of her child. So it was, instead of being something that you expect to help, it was very painful and required a lot of pastoral counseling. And so it doesn't always work like people think. That's what I wanted to say.
And how is your mother doing now?
Well, it's years later, and she's doing better. She's, as people always recount, that never goes away, I think, for a parent, but the pain of losing a child, of course.
Of course. Rabbi, anything you would weigh in? I mean, is this an experience that people have, doubting their faith, doubting their community, even in a time when, the loss of a child, which is so difficult to cope with?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm sorry to hear the story. And in times of loss of a child, there's little that that religion and a rabbi can say to comfort the person, but the person who experiences it as a guilt feeling and as and feeling that that she didn't perform the correct religious rites, I would reassure someone that the rites are there to help guide us in a way that is meaningful so that we can help approach God, but they don't prevent, in the Jewish tradition, it doesn't prevent someone from going to heaven. If the rite was not performed at the end of life, that the person can still go to heaven. And in Judaism, we have the laws of Shiva, which are mourning. There's a seven-day period of mourning a loss after a death, and it continues for a year for a parent. And these the laws of Judaism are there to help guide a person who experiences loss, because as much as we say that religion can help us in times of beauty and appreciating God, wonderful moments of life, religion is also there to help us and to help the entire community comfort someone by providing them with an answer at times of crisis and at times of grief. And this is where Judaism is especially strong, because in Judaism we're a religion of laws that can guide you through every aspect of life, both in waking up in the morning and at times of going to sleep. There are laws to follow and how to lead your life. So even if your soul is feeling lost, if you're overwhelmed by grief, you can still turn to the direction of the law and use that as a way to control your life and take control from the world which might be escaping from you.
Thank you. Claire, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story as well. Let's go now to Larry in Bangor, who has a question. Larry, are you still there? Larry, if you're there, you can go. Larry, if you're there, you can go ahead with your question.
Okay, I got to turn off the radio. I got to turn off the radio.
Okay.
I just wanted to add, obviously we're all upset about what's happened in Connecticut. But, you know, before that ever happened, Mother Teresa has given up her faith. She's acknowledged that no merciful God would ever allow people in Bangladesh and wherever else she happens to be working at the time to starve and to be in such pain and not such agony. And I'm just trying to emphasize that you can be a good person. I don't think anybody would ever doubt that Mother Teresa's a good person, but she's totally given up her faith. She accepts charity from the Catholic Church, but she says, I'm not a Catholic anymore. I can't be.
All right. Do you have a question in there as well, Larry?
No, I simply wanted to add to the gentleman who was talking about atheists being, you know, good people.
Sure.
To me, I don't particularly care what someone's religion is. What I measure is, are they good?
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. And now we're going to take a call from Anthony from Portland. Anthony, go ahead, please.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for allowing me. Anyway, brief questions. One, to the Islamic representative, somebody talk on behalf of the Islam?
Yes.
Yeah, my question actually is, I came from a country where it was ruled by Islam. But that Islamic, the way they interpret Islamic system, they said if you are an Islam, a Muslim, killed a Christian or a non-Muslim, you are straight to heaven or to whatever they believe is a safe place. So is that true in your Islamic religions, or is there any division between Islamic religions? Because the one we have, they believe when you kill a non-Muslim, you'll go straight to heaven or to whatever. I don't know whether they believe in heaven or what. I don't know. I'm a Christian.
All right. Omar, are you able to take that question?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you so much for asking that question. I appreciate it. The Quran says it very clearly. If you take the life of an innocent human being, it did not specify if you take the life of an innocent Muslim, innocent Christian, innocent Jew, innocent atheist. It says an innocent human being. That is any human being. If you take the person's life, it is as if you have taken the life of the entire humanity. So your experience in any Muslim, I am from a Muslim country myself. I'm originally from Gambia, West Africa. And the way some people interpret the Quran or interpret Islam, it's absolutely wrong in the sense that they say you can harm anybody. Being religious in Islam doesn't just mean you go to the mosque on Fridays, you pray, and you do your five daily prayers, and that's it. Being religious to us is that you fulfill the rights of God upon you, and you also fulfill the rights of humanity upon you. Meaning you cannot go and pray and do your duty towards God and be mean and horrible towards the people that He created. The creation of God is just as important as your worship. The creation of human being, you're supposed to be just as kind and honest and protective of your fellow human beings as you take care of your duty towards God.
All right.
So the idea that you could harm people in that sense is absolutely false and absolutely wrong. And if people did not care, that's why I would like to repeat, there was a story of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, where there was a funeral procession going by, and it was a Jewish man who passed away. And he stood up in respect for the Jewish man who they're taking to bury. Somebody said, "It is a Jew, O Prophet Muhammad." And he says, "Isn't it a soul that has passed away?" So if it's true that Muslims are allowed to harm human beings with no regard, he wouldn't have done that. So it's absolutely wrong that Muslims are supposed to harm people and they go to heaven.
All right. Omar, thank you so much. 1-800-399-3566 is the number to join this conversation. We're going to take another short break, and when we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
On the next Backstory, Americans have a history of worrying about end times, of looking for signs of impending doom. In the 1930s, one of those signs was FDR.
Here was a guy who, at the Democratic National Convention in 1932, on the first set of ballots, got 666 votes. 666 was traditionally the sign of the Antichrist.
A history of doomsday in America on the next Backstory.
Join us for Backstory this afternoon at 1.
For many of us, the best part of the holidays is the chance to see old friends or to hear them. For several decades now, Paul Winter has made our holidays brighter with his winter consort and musical guests at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I'm John Schaefer. Join us for the performance, Paul Winter's 32nd Winter Solstice Celebration from NPR Music.
Join us for that Winter Solstice Celebration Friday evening at 9 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Sharon, and today for Keith Shortall, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, another in our What Does It Mean series. Today we're asking, what does it mean to be religious? With me in the studio, Akiva Hertzfeld. He's a rabbi at Congregation Sherry Tefila. Pamela Shelberg. She's assistant professor in New Testament at the Bangor Theological Seminary. And with us from our studios in Bangor, Omar Kante, Outreach Coordinator at the Islamic Center of Maine in Orono. Please join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpb.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. We're going to take a call now from Carol in Portland. Carol, thank you for calling. Please go ahead.
Hi.
Hi. Do you have a question?
Yes. I wanted to say that for me, it's just as incomprehensible the deaths of 26 children or 26 children and adults, as to realize every morning that I'm alive, that to realize that I'm going to die, that to realize that my children were born, my grandchildren were born, that my parents died before me. I find life incomprehensible, and religion provides solace. It provides a system of laws by which to live, to guide us through life.
Well, that was a very beautiful statement. Pamela, would you like to weigh in on that? Is there a question too, Carol, or are you just sharing with us how you have moved through the events of the last few days?
I'm adding to what the rabbi said.
Thank you so much. Our next caller is Barbara Joy from Penobscot. Barbara, thank you for calling Maine Calling. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, just a little bit of my own experience. I was brought up as an Episcopalian, and as a child, I just loved the music and some of the scents. I was like in awe of the mysteries of religion as a child. And yet as an adult, I encountered a great deal of hypocrisy in both some of the congregations I was part of, as well as the ministers. And what saved me was becoming interested in Native American spirituality, which really spoke to me in the way that it embraces the nature and the masculine and the feminine, and not so much the patriarchy that I experienced in religion as an adult. My question for your panel is, how do you respond to people, not just me, but other people that have felt betrayed by, you know, some of the situations that have occurred in different religious congregations? And I'll just go off the air and listen for your answer.
Thank you. Who would like to go first? Pamela, we haven't heard from you in a bit. Would you like to take that on?
Not really. Sure. Do you know, I'm sympathetic with the caller's statement because the betrayal that many people have felt, her word betrayal, I think speaks to an experience that many people have had. And I'll speak from my own tradition in Christian churches. And it is the case that in the same way that I believe religious traditions can give us the kind of a language to imagine God, to imagine ourselves better than we are, to imagine ourselves carried in the power of love, in the same way that religion has the potential and the promise to build us into communities that bear love into the world, we are still human communities. And so it will be the case that in our humanity, we will almost in a nanosecond turn that promise into things that are problematic, the ways that we will circle the wagons and use religious identity to make boundaries, to become exclusionary and to make boundaries between in and out, boundaries between good and bad. So it is, she speaks to the opposite side of the same coin of the promise and the problem for what religious traditions have to offer. I would say that for me, I continue to make a commitment to religious communities because I have hope for the promise, and that it is within the religious communities that we find ourselves held accountable for the ways that we do the very thing, and that we find the resources to respond hopefully in constructive ways.
Jordan in Herman has a question about coexistence, which seems like a nice transition from that last question. Jordan, if you're there, please go ahead.
Of course. Firstly, I wanted to thank the panelists for kind of facilitating this discussion. It's really nice to see some people from different faith backgrounds actually having this sort of conversation. My background is that I have begun working this year on my college campus at Colby College on a multi-faith council, which brings together members from different faith groups on campus and atheists and agnostics to sit and discuss religion problems. And I'm also really involved with the chapel group. I'm a Lutheran. And so I've seen the power that dialogue can have. But I wanted to know if you all have an opinion of how we can better increase that dialogue so we can avoid some of these misunderstandings and some of this animosity between religious groups.
Omar Conte, would you like to answer that?
Sure. Thank you very much for the great work you're doing. I think it's very important that we'll be open to one another and we seek out knowledge about each other. Right now in our world, there's a lot of misconceptions and a lot of, you know, getting information in places that, you know, may not be correct. I think if we open our doors to each other and invite one another, we at the Islamic Center of Maine have been very fortunate to be in this community in Maine where people are so open. They would ask you questions in good faith, you know, without fear. They will come visit us. They will sit with us, and they will discuss any questions that they have about us. And we, you know, we're open to go visit anybody and talk to them, break bread with them. I think it is one of the most important things that we can do as people who claim to have faith and be religious is to be open, to be welcoming, to be warm to people who may not understand what we believe and who may not necessarily, you know, accept our belief and the way we live our lives, but to be open and to have a dialogue with each other. I think it's a very, very important thing, and we've been very fortunate to be living in a state, in a community that people are so open and so kind and so eager to learn about us, and we're also eager to learn about others as well.
Jordan, thank you so much for the call. Michael from Portland has an important question that I've been meaning to ask the panel, and that's about what the difference is between being religious and being spiritual. Michael, thank you for waiting. Please go ahead with your question.
Well, good afternoon. I was raised Roman Catholic in Massachusetts. I went to a Catholic school for 8 years, and it was during a time when the Vatican II ecumenicalism was alive and thriving. And what it did, it allowed us as young students to have interfaith dialogues with people of different faiths, and you know, it was a beautiful time. It was where many times I felt that the conversations transcended the religion and really hit the spirituality, the connective tissue. You know, of,
so
really what
Michael, so your question is, as if I understand it, is what does it mean to be religious and what does it mean to be spiritual? What's the difference? Is that the nub of it?
Well, the nub is this, is that my training in Catholicism gave me a vessel, gave me a cup to hold spirituality. The religion built that for me, right? When I, at a later date, left the constructs of Catholicism, realized that I still had a cup. I still had a vessel to bring in different spiritual expressions. And that's why I consider myself a transcendent Catholic, you know, because I have no regrets about my Catholicism. To me, it was a stepping stone on the way to different spiritual expressions that were ready for me and, along the path of life.
Okay, well, that's a deep question, and we have a very short amount of time, and I'm just going to see if Pamela would like to weigh in at all about what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. Pamela.
I'm thinking about what the earlier caller, Carol, spoke of when she talked about life being incomprehensible. And that would go back to what I had said earlier about our being wired for mystery. And so we do have that, and it is the cup of our religious expressions that I think give us language, ritual, liturgical expressions, things that shape our imagination in the direction of being open to the incomprehensibility in all its, I'll say beauty, but not all its prettiness, beauty, and sometimes it's just sheer incomprehensibility.
On that note, and that was a great note to end on, we do have to close. Akiva, Pamela, and Omar, thank you all for joining us today. Akiva Hertzfeld is a rabbi at Congregation Sherry Trafila. Pamela Shellberg is an assistant professor in New Testament at the Bangor Theological Seminary. And Omar Conte is outreach coordinator at the Islamic Center of Maine in Orono, where he is a graduate student. I'm Susan Sharon, sitting in for Keith Shortall today. Thank you to all the callers.